asked Melody and William the idea that they own it all. And how do they own it all? Do we actually own any of the things in our life? And if we didn't own any of the things that we've ever purchased with our labor in over the course of our lives, then perhaps that would help us to understand why, in light of the FEMA's International Code Council, the Model Codes and Model Acts, the International Property Maintenance Code, all of the various and sundries that come down on us and at us from FEMA, are in place, simply because they believe, at least from their own understanding of the Federal Reserve fraudulent note, that we don't own anything and that it's not possible for us to pay for anything, and that everything that we have, we touch, is in a lien. It's a lien against our property. We've never bought anything. There was never any payment. And so we've just been living under this fraudulent concealment.
So after looking at the information that they have come up with, did that kind of make you have to rethink things any, or were you pretty much on track with what they were talking about?
Everything that is in the book has been in my mind for years. What this basically is it's a clear statement. When I first spoke about the book on my own broadcast, on the Oracle Broadcasting Network, and of course I've been here on KHEN as your guest before, but when I spoke about this book after I had read it, the first thing that this book struck me is, number one, there's lots of white space. Number two, it's an expensive book, and it's not that many pages, about 220 pages. Number three, it's a sans-serif typeface, which is like a Helvetica style, which doesn't really lend itself to in-depth reading. Number four, it's not very well referenced or footnoted. Number five, all of the sentences throughout the whole book are written in a new English program that came in back in the 40s, partially from the Brookings Institute and others, but it was this idea of the deliberate dumbing down of America. Now, having said that, if you look at that, as I did, it's not the kind of a book that I'm used to reading, and that one that I would naturally just pick up and buy at a bookstore. But at the same time, it may have been, and I intend to interview these gentlemen myself this coming week on Wednesday on my broadcast, but it may be that their intention was to write this book in such a, if you will, quote-unquote, dumbed-down method that even an eighth grader could pick up this book, sit down, read through it, understand what they were trying to say, and not bury them in the details, but just to give them a real clear understanding with repetition that this system is completely fraudulent.
I love how you make reference to all these different fonts and stuff like that I would never have ever figured to even look at. And I'm curious as to why you would pick that, all this other up, besides the fact that you're saying it is written in a much simplified manner.
Yes, well, you know, it's just one of those things that it's kind of a developed thing, really, Melody, because I spend almost all of my days, waking hours, reading. And the material that I read runs anywhere from written and originally published back in anywhere in recorded history, but definitely things that have been published in my library with copyright dates anywhere from the 1850s forward. And so I've also got a considerable quantity of this United Nations-type publications and law, things that you've taken off. You know, you go to the statutes, the codes, the regulations. And so there's a couple of different writing styles that are out there. But really, the bottom line of this is that this is not a scholarly work. It was not intended, I don't believe. Neither of these men are ignorant. I've listened to them on the air. I've spoken with them, and I'm looking forward now to interviewing them. Neither of them are ignorant. They both know their subject very well. But as I said, I think they've written it in a deliberately dumbed-down style so that it's in everybody's language, and it's not a heady work, and it just gets the message across.
Well, that's kind of the impression I got from them when I did the interview with them, is that they just want to get that information out there, and the best way to do it is so that they're, you know, appealing to the audience that's out there, so that they can maybe do something about what's the financial situation that's going on, but they don't have a lot of time to get it together, and so William wants to add something here. Just a second here.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. One thing that I notice on that ploy of speaking to the common man is that the heady people, if we could call them that, probably are deeply invested in corporations and don't have a big interest in their system getting upset and getting the rug pulled out from under them. Whereas the little people who are all paying for it with unemployment and homelessness, etc., are the people who are most likely to survive in the end, make changes, make cultural changes, which is something that I'm focusing on and learning that I'm specializing in. And I think it was possibly a very good choice in how they aimed the book with writing to the common man, just in my opinion.
Well, Robert Rowan, you know, of course, he's a naturopathic MD, and I guess we're just kind of critiquing and reviewing his work for the moment. But he, as a doctor, in his book, uses phraseology that's similar to what I have used in the past on my broadcast, and that is this. We spend an inordinate amount of time in what we might call the alternative media, chasing after symptoms and spending a lot of, you know, spoiling a lot of ink, if you will, and paper on victims. And the way that I look at that from the standpoint of sociology is we're creating two new sciences, two new social sciences, the social science of symptomology and a companion study in victimology. But when I looked at the global problem and came to my conclusion of what I thought would be the most appropriate line of attack, which is the abolition of the established two-party political system, what I was doing in that was setting aside symptoms and setting aside the victims and trying to correctly isolate, analyze, and diagnose the disease. If we can cure the disease, then and only then will we then have a cessation of symptoms and no more victims. And so a good physician always looks at the symptoms, they address that, they study the victims, they see that, but what they're really looking for is the disease. And here in this book, they own it all, including you, Dr. Robert Rowan, uses the same approach. And I think you're right, William, when you look at it from the standpoint, is who has been damaged the most in all of this? Who has had to suffer the greatest deprivation in all of this? And that is mom and pop America, all of those of us who live in this country, whose ancestors perhaps have always lived in this country, certainly mine, have been here from the early 1700s or late 1600s. I have a stake. I have a dog in this hunt. And it's the common people that have been bilked. And a lot of the people that have great wealth are not impacted by any of this because they don't really care whether the money's backed by anything or not. They have so many of those digits that they're just living in the lap of luxury.
They're digit dizzy.
Exactly.
I have my thesis breaks up into five or six parts. I start with a consideration of the symptoms, which are loudly spoken of very much. We're all are a bit belly aching about symptom this, symptom that. And I started looking, yeah, but where's the problem? Where is a solution following that? And I began to see after much studying that there is a common source and a common motivation to a certain party or group or a certain attitude that is the real problem. And it hides, I call it the shadow force. And it exists indeed very much in the shadows. But when we start to see the common elements in all the different symptoms, whether it's population or pregnancy or pollution or violence or drugs or something, underneath it all, there's a common element. And that common element takes us back to the people who seem to own the Federal Reserve and certain few people who want to run the world. And they just hide in the shadows, pull strings that pull strings that pull strings, and indirectly cause all these symptoms that keeps us busy looking at, oh, another new symptom has arisen. It's on the news tonight. Did you hear the news? Ignore the news. Let's look underneath. Let's go deep tonight and to what is the source of all of these symptoms we're having. I call it the lie because it's a big fraud on us. And if it's really a fraud, I think there is a truth that we can then discover that we can just say, that's a fraud. It doesn't count. It's not real. Let's start living back in the truth again and rebuild humanity.
I think that's kind of what the two men that wrote that book were trying to say, is that was a fraud, correct?
Exactly. And if you take it from a starting point, certainly Andrew J. Galambos, an author that I really like, another man that wrote simply on an extremely complex subject in his volitional science. But what he starts it all out with, we've got to start someplace. So if we could use some basic fundamental building blocks to begin, as far as people are concerned, property is the most absolutely fundamental element to all of existence. As each of us are like a chalice or a container, a vessel, I came across or came up with the idea early in my life that the sole purpose of our body was to provide nourishment, a place to reside or dwell, and an expression, a window, a transmitter, receiver for our minds, and that our spirit resides within us. And so this idea of the body being the number one, the chiefest, most property, even if you start with something simple, like the idea of life, liberty, and property, or as the founder said in the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to understand property from the standpoint that what is property? Well, it's a man's life and all of his non-procreative derivatives of his life. In other words, our children and our wives, they're not our property. They also have this same special caliber. They are also their own property. And so all governments are instituted amongst men to secure the blessing of life, liberty, and property, if you were to use the John Lockean style. But yes, all of our governments are set up to preserve this. So first we have property. And the next thing that we must have in all of this is freedom. And what is freedom? Andrew Galambos defines it as 100% control of my property 100% of the time. And the corollary to that, William, is 0% of my neighbor's property 100% of the time. So it's a quid pro quo on that level. Now, if we can start with property and freedom, then we can understand just a little bit about what Robert Rowan and Ronald McDonald were trying to hit at when they were talking about form and substance, and when they were talking about gold as being the land. Paper has only form. It has no substance. But in their analogy, gold has both form and substance, and it is property, and it represents land. Go way back to the Wataghmont. Go back to early Europe at the time of the beginnings of what we understand as the common law. The natural law is far older than that, but we can begin with the common law, which then became the common law in Central Europe and certainly in England, and that then became the common law here. But if we start with the idea of a transfer of property in those days, we're talking in the 13, 1400s, when you sold a piece of property, when you bargained away a piece of property, they actually would have dirt from that soil. And they would bring that dirt, might be in a goat skin or something like that. But you would go someplace and you're going to exchange that property, and you would give that dirt to the other person, and that person would give you payment, full payment, gold or silver or whatever you had agreed on. Perhaps it would be your freedom. Perhaps it would be the end of your apprenticeship or something like that. But you would actually take the dirt. And when you transferred the dirt, when you transferred the soil, you had transferred something that had both form and substance. So when we came into this country and began, and when our founders chose metals, precious metals, as a medium of exchange, they recognized that element of property. They realized and understood the importance of exchanging both form and substance. But along came Alexander Hamilton, along came the idea of currencies, along came the idea of taxation and all of that, and through the creation of the Federal Reserve banking system and the Federal Reserve note, we went away from the gold certificates, we went away with anything backed by gold or silver, and we went straight into this idea of only exchanging form. And then the whole can of worms that they lay out in their book opens from there.
And one of the things that they do, humans are considered human resources. In other words, we are property now in that process, correct?
Well, I don't like to use human because it just it confuses the issue. A man. You know, we start with man. And we don't need to get gendery all about it because we just start with man and keep it simple. Man is an all-inclusive type of a thing, and go back in history, and you know, this is where we begin. But a human being, according to the political sciences, is a politically socialized animal. And so, we allow ourselves to go inside of word games that we don't understand. We don't possess the meta language. We don't have the language about the language. And so we just allow our schools, our pastors, our teachers, our preachers, the media to bring us into this new dialogue. So we accept this idea of human, and then we accept this idea of human beings. But the humming bees, go back to Mandeville's book on the bees, and you get the idea of the hive community. You can imagine yourself being one of the Borgia popes and looking down in the city on the streets, and you hear all of the noise of the people, all of the humming bees. Well, that's what human beings are. So we could start with an understanding that as man progresses, he then has to almost immediately, even in the Bible says, you leave your parents' home and you come together with a woman, the wife, and then you start to build a family. Well, let's go back a little bit before that, because you were talking about culture, William, and I think it's important to start somewhere. But we start with the man, and a well-ordered man has systems. I like to think of them personally as systems for freedom. But we have systems. I go to bed and I lie down and so on and so forth. And when I wash my clothing or something like that, I have my mother trained me to hang them up in the closet, and I like to fold my socks and put them in a drawer. I've got all this little government going on around me all the time. When I restock my larder, I put things in places that I can recognize. When I stock up the refrigerator, the same thing. When I go through and make a supper for myself, then I follow through and wash my dishes and all of that so that I don't have to wake to a dirty kitchen. All these are self-imposed rules. This is my government. And so when a man joins together with a woman, then hopefully you'll find some harmony there, that you can keep your government going in the house peacefully. When you add children to that mix, now you're starting to build a unit, a social unit, that will then almost quickly turn into a community, if you will, a small village. That word is tricky. You have to be careful. Vilain, village. You're going back into feudalism with that word. But I don't like community because of the uses that it gets today, common, communitarian, all of that, communism. So I'm kind of gun-shy about community. But you start to living together. Let's say there's a craft or a trade that's involved in all this. You might become the millers. You might become the Schumachers. You might become the Smiths. You might become the wheelwrights or something like that, the Cartwright. So all of that begins to develop some kind of a community. And then you need to deal with others because, try as one might, you can never develop self-sufficiency. The best goal you could hope for is self-reliant. We rely on the things that we can come up with on our own. And again, there is a reliance on a supreme being in that. You anticipate that the sun is going to come up tomorrow and that, you know, the seasons are going to proceed through their system. But all of this stuff is where we start to get into community. Now, at that point, and you start to interact with families beyond your own bound, then you start coming into this need for a medium of exchange. And so from that point, you know, we've gone so many different ways. We've tried puka shells and wampum and every manner and sundry of other thing in barter. But ultimately, you're going to find a time where if you have you know, 3 dozen eggs and 2 gallons of honey. The other guy is a carpenter. He wants, you know, he has boxes. He doesn't need your eggs. He doesn't need your honey, but he wants to move a box. What do? You're stuck. And so you either have to bring a third party into it, or you need to have some kind of a medium of exchange. But this is where we got involved in using gold, basically because it was indestructible, it was immutable, it was instantly recognizable. It had it was heavy. It could be weighed. One grain of gold was as heavy as another grain of gold, and so on. So much has happened. Much has happened.
Well, that's. I follow your thinking and logic there very well. The most important unit is the family unit, or the expanded family unit, including the aunts and uncles and grandmas and the baby children and so on, as a unit. And once a number of families need to live together as to form a tribe or a village or community, whatever word we use for that larger group, and by everybody chipping their trades in together and trading it off, they all survive together. But there's also that interest in what common value do we have? How do we then go to the next community 20 miles or 50 or 100 miles away? In the old days, how did that work? Did they all agree on the same value, same amount of gold for a goat skin or an arrowhead or... a barrel of honey?
No, during the Middle Ages, that wasn't the case. And so oftentimes what you would have is you would have the lord of the manor, let's say, and the lord being in subservience to his lord, he would have a liege lord. He would build a town, a ton, if you will, and around his ton he would not only have a church, but he would have his own grounds and things like that. Then all of the serfs would have their place in the hierarchy. Some would have more privilege. They could work in the house of the Lord. Some would work with the church. As many would work the fields. The way that they worked it out would be that they would have 3 or 4 days of the week that they would work for the Lord, one day for God, and the other days were theirs. And so that process worked out, but there was very little exchange between groups, very little. It wasn't until the beginning of the commercial revolution and the rising up of the guilds that we actually started to get involved in going around and having commerce, at least in Central, Eastern, and Western Europe, that we started going around about and having commerce. Certainly there was commerce back at the time of the Greeks in Sparta and the Phoenicians, all of that. There was commerce all around the Mediterranean that we know of. There was certainly commerce in Egypt, the King's Highway, Petra, like a central bank. But coming into the medieval period and coming out of that really is where I like to focus most, because it gives us a window as to how Western man developed. And so it was just one of those things where you came into these awkward positions where you didn't have, let's say, a sword maker, and you needed swords, and so you're going to have to go to somebody that made them, and they would want something for it, and what they wanted, they would get, and they would demand the price.
Ultimately, what they those two were talking about, Dr. Rowan and Ron McDonald, when it comes to the law and that sort, it appears that this country was founded on more of a maritime commercial code law, uniform commercial code law of sorts, and here we have been trying to follow other types of laws and regulations.
Well, not so much. So,
okay.
The law, it's lex mercatoria, is the way you say it in Latin, I believe. The law merchant is one thing. Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue and discovered Haiti, I guess, the West Indies, and returned, he basically became known there as the Admiral. And if you go back and begin with, I think it's Hugo Grotius, Mare Liberum, Samuel Pufendorf, some of those early writers, you begin to understand the laws of the sea and the beginnings of international law, things that have been coming on us and at us. Of course, you know, you've got Denmark, very much a sea power in their time. England, of course, a sea power. But no, when our founders got off the Mayflower and signed the Mayflower Compact and came on shore, they were coming on shore basically bringing with them the common law. And the common law has for its foundation the revealed law, the natural law, which basically is discernible with Bible beginnings. And so it's a different kind of law. It's a law of fair, you know, all of the things that you can find in the Bible, you could just about go through it and identify it. You could start with the Ten Commandments and build it from there, and that's what common law basically is. It's just a real earthy, honest, true way of dealing one with another. What happened when we went into the laws of commerce, Lex Mercatoria, and the influences that were being experienced in England at the time of Sir Edward Coke, King James, the King James Bible, King James, at that time period, the idea of Justinian's, the Codex, what do they call it, Juris Civilis, the Roman civil law was involved in England, mm-hmm. The Admiralty laws were involved in England, the law merchant, the law of the merchant was in getting involved, and a lot of people resisted it, they didn't want anything to do with it, and they came here. But when we get involved with commerce, this is the point that Ronald McDonald and Robert Rowan make in their book, They Own It All. When you get involved in commerce, and we did that, we can rock and run you real quickly right through that. The bankers created the American Bankers Association, and the American Bankers Association created the American Bar Association. The American Bar Association created the Uniform Law Commission. The Uniform Law Commission was formed as a method of doing an end run around these pesky constitutions. They had to deal with all the constitutions of all the several states plus the federal constitution, and so they needed a way around that. They did that through the idea of uniform laws. The Uniform Law Commission had many model codes and model acts. The greatest of all of their achievements was the Uniform Commercial Code. Then we had the Civil War, when the Uniform Law Commission was interacting with each of the states, they created legislative bill drafting agencies in all of the states' capitals. And there's a legislative bill drafting agency in Washington, D.C. Of course, this is all held by lawyers. There's also an international uniform law commission, and that ties us now into this, like the Laws of the Sea Treaty, the United Nations, Copenhagen, and all of that. And so the lawyers basically did an end run on the Constitution, and instead of having three branches of governments, they created one. And the lawyers and the bankers are working in tandem and basically have created this new world order that we live in. But all of this is a violation of the idea of common law. And in this process, the exchange went from form and substance in gold or silver to form only in fiat paper.
So in other words, they weren't just trying to make a uniform standard for exchange. They were also trying to make a uniform standard of regulations at the same time.
Exactly, and it's a system that it's again a key phrase for the listener out there is a meta language and understanding what a meta language is. A meta language is simply a language about a language, and so in the beginning. You know, we always talk about the mysteries and the mystery religions and things like that, and certainly we could go there, but that's a lengthy topic. But the idea of all of these various mysteries originally, they were various crafts. If you knew how to work stone and you became a mason, and it was something that you guarded your secrets. You didn't show your skills. You would go in secret and work your stone. If you knew how to lay out and form an arch, then you were even more special because arches were in big demand. The architect, the great architect of the universe and all of that stuff. But what happens basically is that man has, as he's progressed, he obtains some kind of a specialized skill or a knowledge, and then he climbs up into the great sandstone wall of life and he carves himself out a niche, the niche builders I call them. Then they wall themselves in with specialized knowledge and skills and hang a little sign out and sell their services to all that pass. So this idea of the niche builder then, the law profession is just as guarded about their niche that you have to use law dictionaries and case law to try and figure out any of the things that they actually write. It's obfuscatory from the beginning to the end, and it's written that way intentionally. So we think about legislators and lawmakers. Well, that's a perversion of the idea of a representative. It's a different word. A representative is a difficult enough concept, but a lawmaker is just simply a testimony that the third branch of government, the judiciary, has taken over all branches of government.
But you're not talking about the administrative of the fourth branch.
Well, the administrative branch is the creation of the very same judicial branch through this legislative bill drafting agencies. The idea of first of all, of creating corporations and then having all of those corporations being semi or quasi-governmental, quasi-constitutional, and quasi-private, that public-private partnership, let's call it FEMA, or the federal, what is it, not UNESCO, I'm trying to, the education group. There's so many of them. Yeah, there's just so many of them.
Yeah.
It's almost mind-boggling. But that is another little wrinkle in this thing, too, is because when you go inside of the agencies, they're not running on law. They're not running on statute. They make regulations and policies, and that's what the Federal Reserve Board does. They create the policies, the broader policies for economic monetary and fiscal policy for the nation. And so it's a different thing, too. With those agencies, redress is exceedingly difficult. And getting them out once they've come in is almost impossible. It's like trying to pull a tooth out of a hen.
One of the things that I better not get off subject there, but it kind of ties in a little bit, but ultimately, when you have this kind of a system being morphed into another system, it gets quite confusing. And I think this is what these two were trying to do, is try to make it more clear. But in the meantime, when what's really coming out of this, unless we draw some kind of making the an even playing field with corporations, man doesn't stand a chance against trying to have any kind of equal footing there.
Standing is a good one. Status is a good one as well.
Okay.
But no, this is not an easy problem. This last weekend on the 22nd, on the anniversary, if you will, of the assassination of John Kennedy, all across America, at all of the various Federal Reserve branches, there were End the Fed rally. Well, you know, I just feel in my heart for them. You know, it's nice to go out on a Sunday when the Federal Reserve staff are all gone and only the security guards are there, and everybody's at home after church eating their dinner, standing on a sidewalk, walking up and down with a sign might make you feel good. But it's not going to produce any lasting result. The idea or the approach that Dr. Ron Paul is trying with his bills to have the Fed audited as an opening salvo is admirable, and it might go someplace. I don't think it'll go very far. So that's why on my broadcast what I try and get people to understand is that the established two-party political system stands between where we are today and where we can hope to go into greater and greater freedom and less tyranny in the future. The problem is that there's nothing in our Constitution and none of the state constitutions and in none of the Federalist paper or the Anti-Federalist paper or any of the writings of the founders that can support the creation of these parties, political parties. As a matter of fact, they wrote and strongly, and all the way back to Coke and Blackstone and others earlier in England, they cautioned against parties and factions. But what we allowed was there our house to be divided. Matthew 12 and 24, a house divided cannot stand, a kingdom divided against itself shall surely fall. We allowed ourselves to be divided, but we were divided upon a very specious basis. Initially, we were divided upon those that were heavily engaged in the Industrial Revolution and those that were yet involved in agriculture and export. And so our nation during the Civil War, the War of Northern Aggression, was divided on that line, which then created this false sense of party, North and South, Union and Confederate. We were divided at the very beginning with Alexander Hamilton, Alexander Levine Hamilton, the bean counter from the West Indies. If he wasn't an agent of the Rothschilds, I'd be surprised. But nevertheless, he's in as an aide-de-camp to Washington, and he's involved in the whole process and a principal author in the Federalist Papers. And he comes up with the idea immediately for a strong central government and a strong central bank. That drives Thomas Jefferson out of his mind, got Aaron Burr's feathers flying, and so we were dividing the house from day one. So the whole idea is to divide and conquer. It's an old technique, and it's a tactic. It's been used against us. We need to be intelligent enough to look at this system and realize that as long as we allow it to continue, that it will continue to divide us as people, but it also stands as the barrier between us and our government. Go ahead.
One of the main things that it seems to be driven home in our media today is that very fact of dividing us. It doesn't matter what rhetoric they use. It seems like they're constantly trying to pit us against each other.
Absolutely true, and it doesn't really make any difference whether, you know, it's pluralism. If you want to go back, listeners, and study it out, look up pluralism in your encyclopedias, your early ones, or go up and do a web search for it. But pluralism is really the idea. This came out of the early socialist, Harold J. Lasky, one of the early socialists that promoted the idea of pluralism. But what pluralism basically is a transformation of government. Everyone has been attacking their constitutions. This is a model government that, if it were ever tried and used, I believe it would be exceedingly successful. And the black nobility of Europe loathed, detested, and despised it. The Pope of Rome loathed, detested, and despised it. And they, in the Verona Treaty, they said so. But anyway, we find ourselves in a situation where on every turn you would have pro-life and pro-abortion. You would have people who are pro-segregation and people who are anti-segregation. You have every division that you could possibly have, and it's not by accident. It's by design, and if you look into, like, Rene Wurmser's excellent book, The Foundations, Their Power and Their Influence, you'll find that the great foundations, through philanthropy, have been financing both sides of these foolish arguments. And so, you know, it's coming at us in a thousand ways, but thankfully, through the Internet, we are waking up to it. And enough people are starting to hear words like these that they might be able to look at the established two-party political system and realize that they bought into a false belief system. I mean, trying to get people, Melody and William, to give up their Republican Party or their Democratic Party is about as hard as trying to convert a Baptist and make them a Mormon. You know, it's
yeah,
a belief system.
I've noticed that.
Will, just real quick, could you repeat the name of that book, Foundations of...
Yes, that was a book that was written by Rene Wurmser, W-O-R-M-S-E-R, and that book's title is The Foundations, Their Power and Their Influence, and the place that I know that you can get it is from Dr. Stanley Monteith on the Radio Liberty broadcast, I think it is. You could maybe Google that, and I believe he carries it in their bookstore.
One of the things that Ronald and Robert were talking about on utilizing the state constitutions, that was a something I wasn't really expecting. What did you think of that answer for?
Well, the way that I've styled this is that if we can become vocal local, first of all, as globalism transitions from global to local, that concept is known as localism. All right? Now, localism is something that's coming on us and at us from the Tavistock Institute and the Brookings Institute and lots of other places, but just bear with me. You can, and folks, you can go to my broadcast any morning. I'm on 5 days a week on the Oracle Broadcasting Network from 9 o'clock until 11 o'clock Central Time. Just click on the link and you listen live. The archives are free. Listen anytime, day or night. But for many months, I've been on the radio teaching on this, but basically,
and way to plug it, too, because, that, I mean, I'm sorry I didn't do that.
I'm plugging it, you know, but it's oraclebroadcasting.com, folks, and then it's just simply become vocal local. So as globalism transitions from global to local, we become vocal local, blocking the globalist agenda right where we are. It begins in our towns. It begins in our cities. It begins in our counties. It begins in our states. And in this way, we can begin to take these two parties over. Now, I hate to tell you this, but we're just, whether we have to weld our noses closed, whether we have to throw salt over our left shoulder and wave a willow wand, we're going to need to energize within this two-party political system, because there is no way short of an armed insurrection, revolution, to get rid of this beast. We have got to gain a majority in these two parties, which can be done, then vote them back together in convention, and then take them out of existence entirely. We don't need the parties. We have a constitutionally limited Republican form of representative government if we can keep it. And so I'm just simply suggesting that we go back and start there. Why? Well, largely because the Federal Reserve banking system was created by the Congress and the Senate and signed by a president. That is the quickest way to get rid of it. You bring it into Congress, go to the Senate, and take it to the president, and it's gone. With the political will to do so, it could be gone before the end of the week. Now, the same thing goes throughout the whole board. No one little piece of this is going to solve it for us. We need to understand how huge and vast this system is, and before we go in and yank somebody's front tooth out, we ought to have a replacement set in mind. And so it works the same thing for all of this, because this didn't happen overnight. This has come on us for well over 150 years, and we're going to need to do what I call Operation Clean Sweep. We're going to have to go all the way back up to the attic and start sweeping out these executive orders and all of this stuff that's going on in the administration, the executive department, that branch, clean that out. Then we're going to need to go down through all of the statutes, then down through all of the agencies, through all of the codes and all of that. This has to be unwound. It's like a Gordian knot. This is going to have to be unwound. It'll need to be done gently, or the cure could be worse than the disease.
What do you think about the
that's a good project.
What do you think about the notion of the, you know, boot 'em all out theory?
Well, boot 'em all out doesn't work unless you know how to boot 'em all out. You're not going to boot 'em all out with electronic voting devices.
Well, that I realize, but what about putting a lock on the door?
Well, putting a lock on the door is the same sort of a thing. You could call a general strike. All right, but how are you going to get them to go away? They're not going to go away. And the problem is the government abhors a vacuum. In other words, it's like anything else. Business is the same way, but government particularly. If you go in, just think of a laboratory flask, and we're going to put a rubber stopper in the top of our laboratory flask that has two holes in it. And to one of those holes, we'll put in a glass tube and run it over to a vacuum pump. In the other one, we'll put in just a simple glass tube. Well, you turn on the vacuum pump, and sure enough, if you put your finger on that little tube, you can actually create a vacuum in the flask. But as soon as you remove your finger, it'll fill up with what you just took out of it. And that's the problem with government. You can throw all the rascals out. Carol Quigley wrote about it. But other rascals will just come right back in. So what we really need to do is to hook up our laboratory flask to that vacuum pump. But in the other hole, we can put in a pipette that has a funnel and a valve. And then we close the valve, create the vacuum, but then we're going to have to pour our replacement set, the good, the clean, the pure, the powerful, positive, constitutional-minded people, into our little funnel and then open it slowly. And in that way, we'll fill the flask with what we want and not get a replacement set of what we don't want. Now, and in this process, we have to understand that the moneyed people, the moneyed interests globally, will do everything and anything that they can do to corrupt the people that we bring in. And so that means we need to look for something other than politicians. We're looking for representatives, but we'd have to save that definition for another broadcast.
So in other words, the only thing I can see here is to kill the desire on their part to want to corrupt the system. But I'm sure that's possible.
That's not possible. All of the people that are in government today, there's only one purpose for political parties. The political party's sole purpose, its primary function, is to put people within reach or within the proximity or power or absolute power. And that's what it's all about. The brass ring of power doesn't know tongue, it doesn't know tribe, it doesn't know creed, it has no conviction. When a man or a woman gets it in their heart to be powerful, when they feel that impulse for power, it doesn't make any difference. They'll kill their children, they'll stab their husband, the husband will kill the wives and the children. When they want power, they'll reach for that ring. And unfortunately, all of the Congress whores in Washington, and most of them that are in our state legislatures, they're in the same boat. They're looking for power. What we need to do is replace them not with people that are seeking power, but people who are willing to serve for a short time in a very kind and gentle way as statesmen, if you will, although I don't like that word, but that's a subject for another story.
As far as the definition of the person who seeks power, and we recall it, the expression absolute power corrupts absolutely. For a more thorough study on that, you could read the book by Scott Peck called People of the Lie. And he defines very clearly and lays it out what evil people are like.
That's the whole thing, is having we're trying to deal with a system that has no morality, and the whole idea is that we got to have. I mean, it just not we're not going to function as long as we have an amoral setup, and that's what we have when we have corporations and people that are groomed to be amoral.
Yes, and that's important because at that point we have to get a real checkup from the neck up. We have to understand that for the last 60 years we have been turned into the same kind of beasts, all of us, that we have in Washington. Try and find a good, the clean, the pure, powerful, and positive person that is not putting his own interests before everybody else's in this day and age in America. And you're going to be searching high and low. That's what I do. I'm always looking for someone like that I can help to get into a position, a lower level position in politics. And I'll tell you, they're few and far between.
Well, yeah, but Agreed. There's one of the things that I've noticed, and I am glad to hear that you said, you know, the election system is, you know, it just needs to be tossed. But I also noticed, and even though they had electronic voting, they still did every other trick in the last last elections to take over. And in case the electronic system may not have failed them or had failed them, they still had all the other cheating methods.
Well, the way that I've set up this system that I'm talking about when I say become vocal local, we don't start at Washington. Washington is toast for a while. It's just going to be what it's going to be. But what we do have the power to do is we can begin in our own local voting precinct. The local voting precinct, some places it's known as a township, sometimes it's known as a ward. Some places they're just not around. They need to be created. But the local voting precinct is the fundamental building block of a constitutionally limited Republican form of representative government. Every county, not every county, I mean, well, in places where that do have counties, they are divided up into these smaller political subdivisions, if you will, known as voting precincts. Everybody has a voter's registration card. You want to know what precinct you're in, just take your voter's registration card out and look at it. It'll tell you. And so that's the place where we can actually have the most power. We can begin right there. And by developing a local voting precinct group and finding someone that lives right close to you, you don't have to travel to Washington for any of this. You're just working right close to home. You find people who are around you that are interested in what we're talking about, that understand that there's a great problem. And what they do then, basically, is we run them and win them. They declare their candidacy. We run them and we win them as county committee men and county committee women for both of the two parties. So you need four people per voting precinct. And in some counties here in southwest Missouri, we have somewhere between 14 and sometimes 18 voting precincts per county. And so it doesn't take very many people, 25, 30 people, and you can actually control both parties in that county. From that time forward, you've got one county down. Go on, work on the next one. We've got 3,066 counties in this country. We've got about 178 or maybe 179,000 local voting precincts. You can see we're not talking about millions, but we are talking about doing something.
Well, I guess we probably ought to bring it to a close here. And as you bring it to a close, there's also one other question after you've narrowed that down. And I wanted to hear your take on this Project 350 thing.
Okay, what is Project 350?
So you've not run across that.
Project 350?
Let's do KHU.
Okay, it's something that I've seen it's got an internet presence, and it's something I think that the UN has set up, but it's being done on a commercial, local level, and it seems to be another entity and way that they have worked their Agenda 21 process in. So.
Well, one of the things that I definitely know in closing is this, and that is that localism is their ploy. And so what they're trying to do right now through Freedom Works organizations and things like that, the taking over of the Ron Paul movement, the Tea Party movements and all of that, is they are doing the same thing that I'm talking about, only what they're trying to do right now, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, is they're trying to get people to come back into the fold. People don't do that. It's a box canyon. It's a trap. What we need to do is to divorce ourselves in our minds from the concept of established two parties as being the system of government that we were given, understand, recognize, and respect our birthright, and claim it again.
And, Will, I want to thank you very much. And, by the way, 350 is 350 parts per million, I believe, on the I think it has to do with the carbon.
That has to do with carbon, and
yeah.
The whole thing is a fraud, and people just don't believe a minute of it. Man-made global warming is a hoax.
Amen.
So, again, I want to thank you very much for the on-the-cuff coming on our program, and you added quite a bit of expertise, and I might have to get a dictionary with me next time when you get you back on here.
You could at least give me more than 5 minutes' notice.
Well, that I would have loved to have.
Thank you very much for the coming on in 5 minutes' notice. That was a tremendous service, and you're greatly appreciated.
Yes, and so again, have a good evening, and thank you very much, Will.
All right, thank you, Melody. Good night, Will.
Good night.